Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvitarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is June 16th, Tuesday, and 10 a.m. Before we get started with this episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hoklamilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial. Now, today is a pretty interview-heavy episode, so without further ado, let's get into the very first one. This is an interview I did with East Vancouver Death Cafe host, Ava Quissy. Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvitarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Death is an inevitable part of all life, but also something that not many people feel comfortable discussing. That's understandable. It's something that we can never truly know, and that's a scary concept to contend with. However, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be talked about, and for many, talking more about death can be something that is healing. That is what certain gathering events dubbed death cafes are trying to show. The Death Cafe, as it's structured today, has been around for over a decade, originally hosted by a man named John Underwood in the UK. Since then, variations of the Death Cafe have been hosted all over the world, including right here in Vancouver. Recently, CJSF was made aware of a Death Cafe series being hosted twice a month at different venues around East Vancouver. We wanted to learn more and got in touch with the lead organizer, Ava Quissy. Ava Quissy is a recent SFU graduate of political science and someone who, after speaking with her, clearly loves talking about death. During our conversation, we spoke with Quissy about why she started these death cafes, some of the conversations it's created, and how talking about death doesn't have to be so scary. Please take a listen.
My name's Ava. I'm actually also an SFU graduate. But I host Death Cafes in Vancouver, which I've been hosting for about a year now, on and off. And it's something I'm really passionate about, really interested in conversations around death and grief and community building. So, yeah, happy to be here.
What made you start organizing these events in the first place?
Yeah, so I actually took a class at SFU, HUM3, what's the course code? Okay, I forget, but by Jason Brown, and he taught this class called Death, Disease, and Disaster, something like that, and it was all about, like, culture's response to tragedy, death being one of those things, like, thinking about how cultures understand death and such, and that just, like, ignited all these themes in my life that I had kind of been suppressing for a long time about anxiety around death and conversations of grief and change and such. So through taking that class, I came across death cafes, which I ended up doing as a final project in that class, and just read about it, and I was like, this seems amazing. So I did a death cafe with a small group of friends, like six people in my friend's house, and it was just super, super moving and just a really beautiful experience. And I was like, everyone must experience this. So then a little while later, I started doing them publicly, and now I do them for anybody and everybody.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts are you doing them? Is it, from what I saw online, it looked like you kind of switch venues?
Yeah. Yeah, I've done a few different venues, which has been interesting because depending on the venue, like, you can obviously get different people, and it's been interesting to see how it's changed as I've facilitated in different spaces and tried different things. But I've done The Slice of Life, at East Cafe, at Secret Lantern Society, all based in East Vancouver. And then in the future, I'm hoping to do some outside and do some cool, like, collaborative events. So especially as the weather gets warmer, to, like, be in an outside space and have these discussions. But yeah.
And what are these discussions? You know, when I saw the premise of a death cafe, is it sort of tailored towards people who have experienced death and are going through a grieving process, or people just wanting to talk about the concept of death in general? How does that work?
Yeah, so the death cafe, there is like an actual format, kind of like quote unquote, comes out of England, like 2011. This guy John Underwood, he started this official thing called Death Cafe, which is a place for people to come together and talk about anything related to death and grief. But it has some guidelines in its traditional format of, like, there's no prompts. It's group-led discussion. It's not bereavement counseling. Like, it's a safe space for people to come together and, like, enjoy snacks and connect and just, like, talk about the philosophical and interests or experiences, whatever. But yeah, I mean, every death cafe is different, and it morphs to the needs of the community. And definitely, as people host death cafes in Vancouver, and I've seen different death cafes happen, people play with, you know, those rules. So I definitely have used prompts before and such. But it's really, like, it's for anybody, it's for anything. Yeah, like, I feel like people typically come and talk about experiences with loss. It is typically more oriented towards like a grief sharing kind of style event. But I definitely have people that come in and are just want to talk about funeral planning, especially if they're like a bit older in age. People come in talking about pet loss. People come in talking about, yeah, like theoretical interests or religion. Like, there's so many different things. So, you know, as long as the space is safe and respectful for anybody, then it really can just be anything. Yeah.
Do you think death isn't talked about enough? Do you think that just, you know, I mean, obviously you host these death cafes, but just on a societal level, it does feel in a lot of ways like a taboo topic, something that provides a lot of discomfort for people. And is that part of what these death cafes are trying to quell or combat?
Yeah, that's definitely where this comes out of, right? The death cafe is a response to particularly like the global North or North American culture having a very sanitized relationship with death, medicalized relationship with death, and how we've been so separated from traditions and experiences with death culturally. So and loss, I think, like just being, I don't know, intimately acknowledging how present loss is in our lives and all the different ways that we experience loss. So the Death Cafe definitely comes as a response to that need and that lack. I definitely don't think it's talked about enough. I think, I mean, my whole basis for being interested in this was feeling such anxiety around it when I was a child. And especially as we live in an increasingly like secular and globalized world, especially in North America, which is this crazy combination of traditions and, you know, a new culture and, yeah, navigating all of this. I think a lot of people feel like maybe a little bit lost in the dark in some of these discussions, and especially from the discussions that happen in these events, I think a lot of people feel really alone in their experiences. So I have just, every time there's a death cafe, the response is so overwhelming and how connected people feel. And that always just points to how deep the need is. And so, yeah, I think there's always more room to talk about these things for sure. Yeah.
How do you feel like your perspective on death has changed since starting these?
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this a little bit in a death cafe I had the other day, where sometimes I'll vocalize in the death cafe, I'm like, oh, people will think that, you know, because I'm in these spaces, yeah, like, what does it mean to always be in a space where you're kind of thinking about death or talking about death with people, you know? But yeah, I think maybe for a certain time, I almost did it as like a defense mechanism. It's like I had this anxiety and it was like, okay, well, now I know I have to face this anxiety. And maybe by facing it, you know, I can overcome it. But it's not about overcoming it. Like, I think I've really had to come to terms with the fact that, like, I'll always be scared. I'll always have fear and there's always an unknown and I can't do anything about that. And that is kind of the essence of the relationship. It's accepting the unknown and it's accepting that I can't control these things and making peace with that in my human experience. And so I feel like that's kind of been one of the bigger lessons of just like, I have to face this. And that doesn't mean that I'm more prepared for it. It just means that I'm like facing it, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I think it's not something that like death isn't something you experience and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm better now. Like
yeah.
I've healed. It's like, totally. It's an ongoing process. And yeah. It's just these spaces are sort of meant to like commiserate and come to terms with that process rather than like quote unquote overcoming it.
Totally. And it's interesting to see people talk about grief. Like often people will use like kind of like fighting words. It's like to fight my grief, you know, to like overcome my grief. And I don't know, you know, like everyone has their own way of making peace, but I think it is about making peace, you know, like our grief becomes a part of us and it's morphs and it changes. And how do we incorporate that into our lives in a real way rather than like pushing it away? Yeah, it's interesting to see the language that people use around it. But yeah, like how can you prepare yourself for the death of your friends and family? You know, I don't know that it's about being prepared or it's about being ready. You know, these things are supposed to be devastating. Like that is the importance of them, you know, like that's the way it is. But recognizing that devastation in community is so, so, so important. And so, yeah.
What is the mood like at these events? That was something I was curious about, because the way you talk about it, it feels so, I guess for lack of a better term, positive. Mm-hmm. But you sound very positive when you speak about it. And I'd imagine that these can be kind of heavy at times, mm-hmm. but what is just the overall mood and tone of these death cafes, or maybe the tone that you try to convey?
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I definitely talk about it and I'm like, my friends are like, oh, how did the last death cafe go? And I'm like, oh, it went so well, you know. But it's like these people are, you know, like we're crying together, and it really reaches such highs and lows in, you know, in positive ways. But it's a full spectrum of emotion, and I always frame it that way going into the space. I always tell people that this is a dynamic space where crying and laughing will happen, and like all of those things are okay. Grief and loss and our feelings about death encompass, like there's so many different ways that they manifest. So to go into an event where we talk about those things and expect to only be sad is just not even a reflection of what it's like to actually experience those emotions, right? Yeah, so I mean, it definitely has, obviously, it's very sad, slow, heavy moments. Of course, there's a deep and intense sharing, but there's just such a community that's created. And leaving, I'm just, yeah, I feel like I'm hugging strangers, and it's like there's such a beauty in that heartache. And yeah, it's kind of almost indescribable sometimes. That's how it feels for me, at least. I feel so filled up by it. Sometimes I get kind of anxious before the events, and then when I leave, I'm just always so moved, always. Yeah.
Do you find that it's been sort of the same people reattending, or is it always kind of a new crowd wanting to speak on death?
Yeah, there's definitely people that come back for sure, which is awesome. And it's been interesting. Something I've been passionate about is creating more of an intergenerational space, because a lot of the death cafes that I attended before I started hosting publicly were maybe a bit more themed and a bit more oriented towards people that were thinking about end-of-life planning and such, which is super important, of course, or thinking about funeral planning. But I was really curious, especially just from my own experience, to tap into the thoughts and feelings of people more in my age group. So creating the intergenerational space has been really interesting, and in seeing how those conversations, like what conversations have come up, and then seeing like my friends show up and like not tell me about it, or like people that I've kind of met, and realizing, yeah, that there is such a need. Yeah, it's also, yeah, like I said, you know, different spaces, different people. So I'm always kind of surprised sometimes. And it's gotten to a point where I do have people that I know show up and they're not telling me. And I'm just like, okay, this is nice. This is a good thing. But I'm finding new ways to try and get the message out there to new groups, because it's really a space for everybody. Like, I think everybody can benefit from being there. So,
yeah, I mean, the intergenerational aspect seems like a pretty important part, because you know, I'm assuming we're both in our 20s. Mm-hmm. And like, when you see when there are older people attending these events, like, it's kind of a fact of life. Like, once you get to a certain age, like, you are going to have experienced death,
mm-hmm.
At some point, or like the death of loved ones in your life. So like, having those people there, providing that kind of perspective for people that are younger and maybe haven't had those experiences yet, or had fewer of those experiences, that feels like a very important part.
Totally. And I think it's like, what does it mean to live the width of your life, but also the depth of it? And we, like, it's so easy to make, you know, relationships with people that are on the same kind of time frame as you, like in your circle. But having relationships with people that have more life experience and less, you know, younger and older, there is something so, so essential about that. And yeah, I was reading about this, like, beautiful indigenous perspective about, like, living your life to become a good elder or a good ancestor. And I talked about this a little bit in my Death Cafe on Wednesday. And I think we've become really alienated from that idea. Like, we get really caught up in, like, what's happening right now and how do I live, you know, especially in this youth-obsessed culture, which definitely bleeds into this fear of death and fear of loss and change and aging, you know? What does it mean to have vibrant, healthy, inspiring relationships with people that are older than you, and to, like, have that reciprocal inspiration of, like, life doesn't end yet, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much taboo just around aging. So I think they're all intertwined in my eyes. And yeah, you want to live every moment as fully as possible, and having those relationships and those insights, I think, really plays a big hand in that, for sure.
How can people who want to learn more about the Death Cafes, like, when they're hosted,
yeah,
where, how does that work?
The promo.
Yeah.
It's a little bit low key right now, but I do post them on Instagram. That's when I host mine. I host, out of various spots in East Vancouver monthly on my own. And then I co-host with a friend out of Playground Studio. Also trying to do that monthly, but so you can check out Playground Studio because we posted it on there. And then I have an Instagram called Looking Out, Looking In, which is where I just post any of my little death related journey stuff. So I always post on there, and then it's also on Eventbrite usually as well. So yeah, keep an eye out.
Once again, that was our conversation with Ava Quissy, host of a Death Cafe series in East Vancouver. This has been Danny Nesvitarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. Thank you again to Ava Quissy for that interview about her Death Cafe series. If you want to learn more, if you want to keep updated on when these death cafes are being held, where they're being held, you can follow the Instagram page _looking out, looking in_ on Instagram. All right. Thank you again. And yeah, if you want to check one of those events out, please do. Definitely important to speak about these things. And I'm glad that we were able to speak about it in the way that we did. Anyways, let's get on to the next interview of the hour. This one is with SFU professor Jen Marchbank about an archive that she's currently building to document the experiences of the 2S LGBTQ plus community in Surrey. Reporting from Surrey, BC, this is Danny Nesvitarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. At Simon Fraser University Surrey campus, a presentation was hosted by Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies, Jen Marchbank. The presentation showcased Marchbank's newest project, a collection of oral history interviews from the 2S LGBTQ plus community of Surrey for the purpose of creating a digital archive. As stated by Marchbank during her presentation, the queer history in places such as Surrey that reside on the periphery of larger cities like Vancouver are often overlooked. The project aims to combat this by sharing the lived experiences of 2S LGBTQ plus people throughout Surrey. To learn more about the project, what it entails, and when it will be released, we sat down for an interview with Jen Marchbank. Please take a listen.
Well, hi, I'm Jen Marchbank. I'm currently the department chair in the Department of Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies. This project is telling our stories, a queer oral history of Surrey, BC. It's part of various projects that I have conducted since about 2010 in Surrey in terms of things like new public histories.
And what spurred you to pursue this project in particular? What was the motivation behind it?
Well, one of the motivations behind it is that I feel that here in North America, we kind of privilege certain cities as being metro cities with safe and active around 2SLGBTQ activities, etc. And I felt that Surrey has not been fully represented in that, and especially important because Surrey is actually the place where we got a Supreme Court decision on school materials being acceptable through James Chamberlain's advocacy, and also the HIV travel ban removed through the advocacy of a man called Martin Rooney. So they were both Surrey residents when they did these important national and international legal changes. And so some of the work I've been doing in the past is to ensure that their voices have been recorded, that they have been, when I did a museum exhibit a couple of years ago at the Museum of Surrey, they were the kind of anchors for that exhibit. But also I want to make sure that we don't just hear about the crises in 2SLGBTQ lives, right? Or we don't want to just hear about people like me who are activists. We get our voice out there. I wanted to record people who connect to Surrey in some way and who just want to talk and identify under the umbrella in some way. I just say to them, here is an opportunity. We have some guiding questions, but please, what story do you want to tell? So some people have told stories about being an activist. Martin Rooney told us the HIV travel ban story. We've had other people talking about running queer youth groups. And some people just about, hey, I grew up in Surrey and I happen to be non-binary.
Yeah, and how have you decided or chosen who to speak to? How does that work? Is it an outreach process or are people coming to you saying, hey, I want to be a part of this archive?
It was publicized on social media and through various networks. But we also last year, certain people we reached out to most definitely, right? And we said, we need you to come and speak about this, please, this, please, this, please. So one of them was, we wanted to have someone who worked in media. So we reached out to Mike Keeping and said, talk about OutTV and the work you do there and all the other work you've done over the years. But we got people who volunteered themselves, or someone would come in and be interviewed and said, you need to speak to so-and-so, I'll get them to contact you. And we put out there our telling our stories one@gmail.com email address so people could do that. We had a booth at the Surrey Pride Festival last summer. And again, that was another way of reaching people. I was really keen to reach people. Yes, there are certain people's voices that stories have to be told, but I also wanted to say, those are not the only voices. And so people who I know who've been involved in previous projects, I asked them to talk about something different if they were in my project.
Another thing that I think is interesting is you talk a lot about, you know, the way in which cities that sort of neighbor these big metropolitan areas, such as the city of Vancouver, are often overlooked when it comes to queer representation and queer history. But, you know, no matter what city you're going to go to or look into, there are going to be queer people there. So there is always going to be something to talk about, some level of history that is worth documenting. But I guess I'm curious because it does feel like the city of Surrey in particular has had this reputation of being less progressive and less open and less accommodating for queer folks. And I'm wondering if part of this project is trying to dispel some of that, or even just share the stories of people that are in Surrey and maybe are struggling with their identity.
Okay, so part of this project was when I came to Surrey and I looked around, and that was 20 years ago. And the very first thing I collected, I decided that I needed to do some public history work, and I started collecting T-shirts and mugs and things like that from various Surrey Pride festivals. I started an excellent relationship with City of Surrey Archives back in 2018. This is a story I told yesterday, that I was at an event. I was on an SFU history panel. I mentioned that I had an archive in my office, and that started my relationship with the City of Surrey Archivists. And that's an ongoing, really positive relationship. Heritage Surrey have been fantastic. I also developed some excellent relationships with the museum curators. And over the years, I have been part of 3 exhibit curations. And my archive stimulated a couple of other people to say, oh, what about me? I can give you this. We'll share. Alex, Amar Sanger and Martin Rooney donated their materials, which meant that when the City of Surrey does its open house days, you know, where you can go in and look at displays at City Hall, at Stewart Farm, or in the museum or the archives, those materials are available. So one, yes, is to make visible to that person who might be saying, I don't know anybody else, I don't feel validated, I really do feel representation matters. So there's that. But also I want to make sure that there's an accurate recording of who's doing what where. And I also think that if people know that this is going on in Surrey, they won't feel the need to always move to another metropolis. I mean, we are a huge city with a great history of activism. It's a slightly different activism. And people are always surprised. You know, when I say to them, June 20th is the 27th Surrey Pride Festival, they go like, what? People still say things like, I didn't know Surrey had a Pride, because we're shadowed by Vancouver. But these days, so, you know, since moving into the Lower Mainland, Delta has a Pride picnic. Langley has a Pride Day. Langley's got a Silver Pride, which is for queer seniors. So there's been those, and there's, you know, the Fraser Valley Pride Society, you know, all the way from Delta to Chilliwack, there are groups of people organising to provide social events, support, information sharing, all those kind of things. You know, they're not just geography based. You know, we have Pinoy Pride for the Filipino community, Share Pride for South Asians and their allies. They're very active. So there's a lot going on. And if we only look around and say, well, Vancouver has a big parade, then we're missing a large part of the picture.
So it sounds like this project is sort of contributing to the effort of representing Surrey's queer community as a whole in a way that maybe it hasn't been.
It's not representing and saying that this is a microcosm of it. It's about, you know, here are the people who are willing to be put on video. So there's a whole lot, that's a whole barrier to a number of people. So I'm not saying that I've got a representative sample in the way that social scientists work with that, but it is putting more voices out there. And at this stage, it is simply gathering the stories. So gathering the stories via Surrey Pride Society, which will then donate them to that city archives. But also we're transcribing into French and English and Punjabi. So this is going to be a resource for anybody who wants to say, I'm just Googling around to find something. Oh, that seems interesting. I think we'll get a few visits from people from England, because there's a confusion between Surrey, BC and Surrey, England. Quite often get Surrey Pride events. We go, no, we're Surrey, BC. But I think we'll be able to get, you know, people will be able to look from around the world and see what these stories are and maybe use them for their own research projects or their high school homework.
Yeah, it's a great resource that you're building.
Well, I haven't analysed it at all yet, because I want it to be complete, and then maybe I'm going to be writing about the methodology of it, the process, why oral history and why oral histories and queers in different places. But at the moment, you know, what will go out is unedited. We told all of our participants that what you see will go out completely unedited, unless you ask us to make a particular edit.
Right.
You know, someone names somebody and goes, oops, maybe I shouldn't have done that. We'll blank out that name.
And yeah, you mentioned that it's going to be translated in 3 different languages, English, French, and Punjabi, which obviously that makes a lot of sense considering the demographics of Surrey. Is that something that is also that you want to represent in the people that are spoken to as well?
Yes, absolutely. And what we've done is, I have done, 10 years ago, I did another project, which was raising awareness about elder abuse in the 2SLD